think some of you probably know me. I have, interestingly, some deep connections here at The Connection. I grew up in Hepburn, and I think a few of you are from Hepburn. I'll know you from that time. Sort of, you know, disconnected from that place in some ways, but found my way here. So I just want to introduce myself a little bit, just a few things about myself. Hopefully to give you just a few handles to sort of like understand where I'm coming from, some of my interests, and why Chris even asked me to sort of fit into this series bit on the table. So my wife Miriam and I have been here at The Connection for I think just over a year now, and it's been absolutely fantastic. And actually part of the draw to The Connection for us was the practice of the table that's here, the weekly, regular practice of the table. That was something that I wasn't introduced to in my growing up, in my previous communities. It was something that was practiced irregularly, and it's something that I've grown to desire and understand as an important and central part of a gathering community. And I think that sort of started to happen. That recognition came out when I was when I started my seminary studies, which was about 4 years ago. Embarrassingly, I'm still not done, but it's been a long road. There was a strong emphasis at the seminary on Eucharist, and they called themselves a Eucharistic community. And the rector there, he had this sort of philosophy, and what he talked about that was really important was the gathering community. I'll come back to that one. He really stressed gathering community, not gathered community. And there was a distinction there that for him was important, that implied some sort of consistency, no ending, that we're a gathering community. And so, yeah, it was partly through those experiences that I started to sort of open up into this world of desiring to understand Eucharist a little bit more. And I think that's partly, again, part of the journey into this place here, into this community, is that. Another little part of my life is that I work at Bethany College. Some of you actually came up to visit, hosted a conference with David Fitch there just a couple months ago in November. It was great to see, actually. I think this church body had probably the most support of any of the churches in Saskatoon for coming out, so really appreciated, really enjoyed seeing you in that context, too. And I've been at Bethany for 4 years in a teaching role. I teach mostly in the roles or the subjects of mission studies and ethics at this point. So I've been enjoying that. It's an extremely pushing role for me in terms of just learning every day with my students. So anyway, I hope that gives you just a little bit of a groundwork for my background. Chris, a couple weeks ago, sort of laid us a wonderful, solid biblical foundation for exploring the table. And I hope that I can build on that. And I actually hope that sort of blesses me to explore a few other directions or a few other dimensions. Rob, last week, he suggested that we explore the table with a vision for seeing it with a sense of wonder. I really appreciated that term he brought up. He talked about seeing this sense of wonder. And so tonight, that's something I want us to hopefully capture, is a sense of wonder in this common practice that we all partake of. And so, I don't know if you want to put on the first slide there. I'm calling this a Eucharistic pilgrimage. And I'm going to come back to this concept of pilgrimage. But the reason I guess the basic reason I want to use this term is, for one, I think it's pretty unfamiliar and probably unorthodox to link the word pilgrimage with Eucharist. And I hope, again, in that sense that Rob suggested, gathering a sense of wonder, I hope that this opens a door for seeing the Eucharist in a sense of wonder, to see it through the lens of a pilgrimage. And the second reason I want to suggest the concept of pilgrimage is that it's actually a very familiar language for most non-Western peoples of other faiths. Pilgrimage is something that is deeply embedded into most religious traditions. And I find a lot of value in seeing through someone else's eyes one of our own practices from a unique perspective. I think sometimes seeing that, you can find even deeper value in something that you've become accustomed to or has become normal than you might even be used to. And I think pilgrimages, from my limited understanding of some of them across some of the different faith practices, are a form of witness. And that's something that I've been really inspired into seeing the Eucharist as, is that it's a form of witness. It's a part of the witness of the church body. It's my witness as I partake to you. It's our witness to one another, as well as our witness to the world as part of a global church, as part of one of the gathering bodies of many. as we remember what Christ has done for us and is doing through us. And so witness, I think, is going to be one of the most important themes for looking at Eucharists that I want to explore a bit more tonight. So, why pilgrimage? My initial motivation starts with a little bit of a story here. So I was just talking to Miriam just before I came up, and I was trying to think. It was 2.5 years ago, one of my seminary classes, I was privileged to take with a man named David Schenck, who's from Pennsylvania. He's worked with Muslims in various contexts for years, doing peace-building initiatives, having lots of theological conversations. The man is just a wealth of knowledge and a wealth of wisdom in sort of interfaith contexts, and understanding what it means to be a Christian witness in those places, and empowering the churches in those places as well. And so I was really privileged to actually have a class with him where we traveled together to Bangladesh for a couple weeks. I wanted to have a very, practical experience, something that wasn't as classroomy. And it was a fantastic time. And in my trip, this was the first time that I was introduced to the concept of Eucharist as pilgrimage. I think part of it, we were in this city called Rajshahi, and it has one of these smaller Islamic pilgrimage sites, and I can't totally remember the story, but it was a man who rode the Ganges River on a crocodile and ended up here. And there's sort of this really interesting narrative that goes along with pilgrimage a lot of the time. Anyway, reflecting on some of this idea of pilgrimage, I was talking with David on one of our bus rides, and he said, you know, it'd make a really interesting paper if you were to write a comparison between the Islamic pilgrimage of Hajj and the Christian pilgrimage of Eucharist. And I was like, David, I've never, what do you mean Christian pilgrimage of Eucharist? And he was the first person who'd introduced me to this. And I'm not sure if he's the originator of that idea, but I haven't found it in too many other places. And for him, it was a place of common ground, a place of a starting conversation for people of other faiths that led him to sort of want to explain some of these practices with handles for people of other faiths, to be able to witness and offer sort of the concepts that would be easily grasped and easily attained. So anyway, that's sort of just the very brief background of how that trip sort of started to influence that. And that was 2.5 years ago. And since then, I've really valued this insight and valued some of the thought that's gone into it. So, from here, I want to take a look, and I think you can click to the next slide here. Take a look at some of the unique features of pilgrimage in general, and how maybe that shapes our understanding of a Eucharistic pilgrimage. And so, why pilgrimage? I've got, in terms of my outline here, I've got 5 thoughts that I want to sort of guide the evening. So the first one here is that I think, and you know, afterwards, if you have any more feedback, I mean, these are just 5 reflections on this. I'm sure we can think of many more ideas of what pilgrimage offers, but these are 5 that sort of came to mind in terms of making this up. One is that pilgrimages seem to have a goal. There's something that we're aiming towards, something that people are aiming towards, or at least journeying towards. I think that can often be like a physical location. It could be an object, an icon, or even a space. If you want to flip to the next slide. In the Hajj, which is the Islamic pilgrimage, there's definitely an end goal. There's a place to pilgrimage to. And this is the Kaaba. It's the most holy site in Islam, located in Mecca, if you're unfamiliar with it. Historically, just a very brief picture of this practice. The Hajj developed as a way for the Muslim community to gather on basically an annual basis as an expression of their consistent centrality of the pillars of their faith. And so it's sort of a reaffirmation of those things. And it's built upon Mecca because that is the place where the Prophet Muhammad returned to the city, where he originally intended to build and construct this sort of ideal Islamic community. And so it holds a significant place, significant space. That's an important aspect for them in their practice. And the Hajj is a giant pilgrimage. It's, I think when I looked up the numbers, it was around 3 million people a year that travel and pilgrim at the same time to this place. Now, in the Eucharist, we have a table, and we have the elements that go along with it. We also have, in a sense, sort of this physical space, a goal that we're getting towards. And we also have sort of a goal of a regular rhythm. Each week we gather, that we know that there's a goal coming. Along with all those other Christian communities across the world, we all gather together on a regular time. We all participate in a similar way, coming to the table and sharing together. And so the goal of the Eucharist, I think, is actually pretty unique. The goal is about gathering, partly, not about being gathered. This is coming back to that concept. And I like this. I like that the goal of the table isn't only about coming to the table, but it's also about leaving the table. And so part of the goal is actually our ability to leave and integrate what we've taken into the rest of our week, into the daily parts of our week. And so the goal of the Eucharist should manifest itself in our departure from it as well. The goal is, in a sense, as we come to the table, unattainable and yet inspiring to us. It's meant to create sort of a hope and a peace for living. It's very eschatological in that sense. And so this is why we're constantly gathering. We're not gathered. We're not simply, we haven't made it. We haven't finished the Eucharist. We haven't finished what it's meant for us. We are constantly a gathering community. We don't want to arrive. We are, in a sense, continuing this practice. And that points to the next slide here, that it's about a journey. I think most pilgrimages, in essence, aren't even about the goal. Although I think there is a goal in mind, I think a lot of pilgrimages have to do with the journey. That there's something important going on as people actually take the trek. And so often I think the goal is the process of it. And I don't think it's not magical, but it can be mystical a lot of the time. It can be something that you don't expect. Maybe that's what I mean by mystical. People practice pilgrimages because it takes them into a different space, a different place, a different way than normal. A new way of being and living that is sort of just fully in the moment. I think that would be a common approach to pilgrimages. And at this table that we'll practice tonight even, we gather because we value this regularity of the practice. In much the same way, we can look at Christ. He valued regularity of practices. He saw his ministry as flowing from his communion with God. And the table provides, in a similar way, I think what Christ did with his communion with God was it provided a pivot point within the rhythm of our lives. And that's what I see the table offering us, is a pivot point within our week for us as believers to focus on similar communion or alignment of wills with the Father. And so we've prayed in this church, and I quite enjoy these songs, "Your kingdom come, your will be done." This is both a statement of reality as we come and gather together, and yet it's also that same idea of that sending forward nature. It's a convicting challenge as well. "Your kingdom come, your will be done" doesn't just simply state a reality. It also convicts us to make that reality happen. And these are statements about continuing the journey. These words highlight the concept, I think, of salvation that is central to the practice of the table. That is both a gift in the future that we get to partake of and a gift for the present. These two things need to be held in some sort of beautiful tension. And so I think we practice salvation today, in a sense, in a glimpse, in sort of a microcosm, and continue to understand it a little bit more each week. That's something the table offers us. It offers us, on our journey of actually understanding salvation, each week we get to get a little bit more of a glimpse of it, as we hope towards that sort of fullness of its understanding that we will one day understand. So the table's a journey that creates space and time as a community to realign our wills with God's. The next thing is seeking transformation. This process of the journey should, I think, lead to some sort of transformation, or maybe if we want to be less sort of mystical, it should lead to some sort of formation, in essence. I was talking with a friend of mine, I think it was yesterday, and he had mentioned that he had a friend, so two removed here, it's not my story, but he had a friend who had just participated on the Camino de Santiago, which is the Way of St. James, popularized in that movie The Way. I don't know if any of you have seen this or not. Is that something people are familiar with? Anyway, it's a pilgrimage in Spain, and I'm actually not even sure. I haven't seen the movie myself. I know it's somewhat familiar to maybe some of us, but what struck me is, in the story of telling about his friend who had gone on this, she said, "It wasn't what I got out of the experience, it was what I left behind." There's something about that in terms of transformation. I think there's often a hope for a sort of, you get this image of a cleansing of the palate within a pilgrimage act. A leaving behind of something. One common theme in pilgrimage is that of purification. I know that's the case with a few of them that I've sort of looked into. And I think that purification is an important thing there. This is important if we all think about what we eat, you know, cleansing of the palate. If I think about what I've eaten during the week, literally or figuratively, however you want to explore this in your own mind here, but the pilgrim's journey, this pilgrimage takes us out of the busyness of our lives in a way where we can reflect on what we've consumed during the week. Again, literally or figuratively, what we've consumed. Maybe we can see our own glut, whether that glut was physical, emotional, maybe it was cognitive glut. I don't know. But we can actually step back and sort of look at these things in a different light. And so I think we can offer this image that perhaps the table can offer a sort of cleansing of the palate in the same way. This pilgrimage to the table that we all partake of is meant to, borrowing a term from William Kavanaugh here, destabilize the community. And I think that's sort of a necessary part to being a follower of Christ, someone that's oriented outwards. You need to somehow often, or more often, be destabilized in your normal. And the way to be destabilized is to catch this sort of tiny little vision of what the kingdom looks like. And that's what happens when we partake of the Eucharist. We sort of see an opening up of the possibilities of something that we haven't been aware of. I think we see a different kind of normal than that we see during the week within the world context that we're in when we come to the table. Here we partake of sort of an image of God, image of the kingdom of God, sorry, that we actually get to share and see together. And I would love to go into more detail about this, but it requires just a whole other conversation, but an important one. John Yoder had emphasized that there is an economic image to the Eucharist. And I think he states it by saying, to do rightly the practice of breaking bread together is a matter of economic ethics. I've reflected on that one for a while, and I think what he means is that we're called to recognize our present condition and the grace we've received and the condition of others, then, in order to draw us into a sort of compassionate response to those in need. That might include condemning economic structures that support that segregation. That might just be our own self-reflection on our... And economic, I think, can be spread out a little bit. But the Eucharist is a call to, in a sense, see with new eyes, whether that be your economic practices, whether that be your relational practices. Something about solidarity that we find here. And that's just one example of a practical implication of the Eucharist. I think that could be applied, again, not only to economics, but to relationships. Maybe as we come to the table, what are we shown this week that is so amazing about our relationship with God that we need to apply that to our relationships with other people in our lives this week? Those are some of these practical implications of this pilgrimage today. So this is one of the ways we are to image the kingdom through the table. It's by finding those application points, by actually making daily changes in our habits, whether that's use of time, use of money, way of relating to others, etc. And this is a picture of the Way of St. James in Spain. So, the next thing is that a pilgrimage is often collective. In fact, I'm going to suggest it's only collective or communal. If you want to flip to the next picture as well, this is... It's called the Kumbh Mela, and it's actually the largest pilgrimage in the world, in India. This takes place basically every 12 years. It's a Hindu pilgrimage, and it far surpasses the Hajj. So I said the Hajj had 3 million people participating every year. The Kumbh Mela, which happened in 2013, had over 100 million people in the same place at the same time, which I just don't quite understand. But it's India, and so it's gigantic numbers and proportions. And pilgrims all over India gather, it's near Allahabad, near the mouth of the Ganges River, to together sort of participate in this ritual, which I don't actually know all the details, but one of the key things is a bathing process for purification within the Ganges River. And there's a whole bunch of different aspects that go along with that. Neat little side note, Mark Twain actually had witnessed this pilgrimage at one point and wrote about it. It is wonderful, the power of a faith like that, that can make multitudes upon multitudes of the old and weak and the young and frail enter without hesitation or complaint upon such incredible journeys and endure the resultant miseries without repining. It is done in love, or it's done in fear. I don't know which it is. No matter what the impulse is, the act born of it is beyond imagination, marvelous to our kind of people, the cold whites. Very interesting anthropological reflection on this thing. I think what I get out of that, even just that small glimpse on a practice like this, is the power of the collective is an amazing thing. The power of the collective moving together. Something that maybe us cold whites, as Twain says here, is somewhat lost on our individualist culture. The power of collectiveness. And that's something I think the table emphasizes in a very unique way. And I think, however, besides this, you know, we can't look at pilgrimages from an individualist sort of way. I think you can never undertake a pilgrimage by yourself. Whether you meet people along the way as you go, or follow in the footsteps of the historical community that's come before you, it wouldn't be a pilgrimage unless others have done it. And I think any young person, now I'll put myself in this category, because I know when I was, you know, after high school, sort of wanting to become a bit more adventurous and things, I found myself wanting to travel, to explore, to experience something new. Quite often born, I'd say, from an individualist desire to see something new, different, or unique. I can be honest about that, and I'm not sure if that applies for everyone. Be able to do it on my own, be able to explore something on my own. That's something I bring with me as part of my heritage, I think. But in my experience of trying to pursue these things, I hope others' experiences of those sorts of pursuits, the most powerful part of any travel experience usually isn't the experiences and the encounters you have, but it's the unexpected relationships that pop up along the way. The actual tangible things that happened to you, that were with others, the collective things that happened. The unexpected. I don't know if it's the most powerful things of travel are the fantasies you bring with you or the idealistic dreams that you have of them, but it's those things you didn't expect to find along the way. And so the table, in this same sort of vein, coheres the Christian community. Past and present, we participate in a journey to receive and celebrate the sharing of God's grace together, seen most fully in Jesus Christ and acted out here, in a sense. So as churches gather in all their localities in the world, which is a really neat part of this, is that we gather as part of a larger global body, not just this individual congregation here. We witness to a God who saves together, who saves us together, by partaking of a practice that encourages this sort of physical response to that with the bread and the juice. And again, I think in doing this together, we catch another glimpse of that central part of the table, which is the understanding of salvation, that it is something that is communal as well. We get a glimpse into the complexity of it. Where Christian pilgrims gather, we remember the past and envision the future. And I think this is important to continually understand salvation in new light, in a communal light, because the witness of the church, and witness is birthed from, I'd say, the communal, not necessarily the individual, cannot flourish without a rich understanding of the complexity of salvation in its own life. I'll say that again. It's important because the witness of the church cannot flourish without a rich understanding of the complexity of salvation. And so I think we know the stories of our Lord. We know the stories that God has witnessed to being a different God, a holy God, different way of living with one another, different way of interacting with people. And we're commissioned through this practice of the table to live that differentness, to live that holiness out as well. And so as we come to the table, together we affirm that we live under the acts of Christ. We are forgiven and reconciled already. And together we also affirm, not only that, we don't just take that with us, but we affirm that we want to live together in the same way that Christ is with us. So therefore we also forgive and reconcile. It's a two-way peace. And so we must first understand all the ways in which salvation has affected or transformed our own lives before we're able to understand and offer these stories to others. So the table's important, I think, because it draws us into this story of God's people, a story that spans scriptures, traditions, and our own current body together. The next slide. This is the final point, is that pilgrimages are an embodied exercise. What I mean by that is it's physical, it's practical. There's something tangible going on here. The pilgrimages in general, I'd say across, again, all the different varieties, link the physical with the spiritual in a very visceral way. It engages our emotions. It also engages our cognitive. It engages our bodies and our hearts. It's just all-encompassing in that sense. There's an inherent belief, and if we go back to just another quick aside to the Islamic pilgrimage at Hajj, the Kaaba represents, on one hand, the link between the divine and the human, the connection between heaven and earth. That's a part of their practice. The Kumbh Mela that I showed you here is a very embodied ritual. Actually, I was trying to find pictures, and it's actually really hard to not find naked men taking baths with this practice. So it's a very embodied ritual. There's a lot of these sorts of very interesting practices within it. The Way of St. James also asks something of you, something more than something simply physical, and more than something just spiritual. The table is also this embodied experience that we get to partake of. It includes physical elements, yes, and points us, I think, both towards desiring to respond physically during the week, but also understanding the spiritual significance behind things. So the table is seen as a missional act, I would suggest, because we partake of an actual taste of God's reign together. So indeed, the potential of the particular actions is meant to offer. And I would say this, as pilgrims, if you want to consider yourself a pilgrim today, or as you partake of the Eucharist, you get a sort of takeout meal. You get a little takeaway, where you're reminded to continue your day-to-day practices with the values that you encounter here. That's a takeaway. Ultimately, I think part of the point is that the Eucharist reminds the Christian community that its gathering is primarily for the benefit of its dispersal. And all pilgrims return somewhere.